Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 97. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing something a little bit different. I am doing one movie, and I'm also going to do a bunch of short films that are available free on streaming media. Some of them are a little older, some of them are quite new, but all of them are really interesting. So if you haven't got time to watch a full feature film, it's good to dip into these ones and just enjoy some really good science fiction. So sit back, I'm going to get the contact details out of the way and I can start the show. Martian Drive-In Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of science fiction, horror, fantasy, film appreciation. It doesn't matter when it comes from, whether it's old or new, in black and white, in colour, 3D, anamorphic. It doesn't matter. If it's interesting, I'm going to give it a go. Now, there are occasionally also roundtable discussions where I get a few like-minded cronies around and we talk about science fiction, of horror, or fantasy, or anything that takes our mind. So the format's kind of loose. Now, you can contact me and leave feedback via feedbackpaleo, that's feedback, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and have a chat there with me and other people about science fiction, fantasy, horrors, or any other kind of things you want to talk about. Apart from politics, I've got another area for that. Please be aware that this podcast does have swearing in it. So if you're going to be listening to it on speakers, make sure there are no children around, unless you want them to learn wider vocabulary than they already have. Hi, how is everyone doing? Today it is bloody windy outside. Apparently it's going to get up to 100 to 120 kilometre an hour wind gusts. So if you hear some strange wind against a window noise in the background, that's the reason why. The man cave window is at the end of a wind tunnel. And there may, just may, be some loud noises. Hopefully the roof will stay intact. Hopefully the fences will stay intact. And hopefully nothing bad will happen to anybody I know. Welcome to climate change. I hope everybody is doing well. We're doing okay, much better than Donald Trump, of course, whose ambitions seem to be going straight down the oubliette. And that's not a bad thing. I have a number of American Facebook friends who seem to be quite cheered and heartened by that. So anyway, what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be talking about Code 46, a science fiction movie from about a decade ago, starring Tim Robbins and Samantha Mathis. And I'm also going to be talking about a bunch of small films that show up in various streaming media, most of which you can access at no charge, but which some of them are based on science fiction short stories, others are independent and original works, but all of them are a lot of fun and kind of get to the guts of what a good science fiction story is. And that's actually something that I've been thinking about for a while, is what makes a good science fiction movie. And I've always had the opinion that it doesn't have to have fantastic special effects, enormous explosions and all the rest of it. We have to like the characters, we have to engage with the characters, I think, because for me the best definition of science fiction that I've heard, and I'm sure that there are people out there that have heard better ones, and I'm more than happy to listen to that, is science fiction is the impact of technology on human beings. And that's kind of a cool, simple, very broad definition of it. And it's not necessarily just human beings. It could be aliens. It could be machines as well. Yeah, that'd be interesting. A science fiction story about the impact of technology on robots and AIs. Yeah, that's a kind of recursive kind of thing. Anyway, it's time to get a little bit back on track and talk about the stuff I've been watching, the media that I have been consuming with the usual avidness. Now, I'm just going to bring up my Letterboxd. I did see a documentary on Netflix. I'm willing to take a punt on some documentaries on Netflix. And it's a documentary from about 2013 called Sample This. It's about a just about forgotten band called the Incredible Bongo Band, who did one track, a version of Apache, which became the basis for a lot of hip-hop culture. The original DJs that were spinning discs used a lot of sampling from Apache, and it kind of goes into the history of the Incredible Bongo Band and the guy who created them, a record producer called Michael Viner. It does a really good job of interviewing people, getting an idea of the start of hip-hop culture, the cultural context in Brooklyn, the whole lot. And it kind of really works, even though it's not a kind of music that I've been particularly invested in. The documentary is really good, and it has a few bands that I like Friends of Distinction get a mention, and a little bit of a clip from Grazing in the Grass, and that kind of thing. So it was quite good. I think maybe watching Luke Cage, which I mentioned that I did in the last Paleo Cinema podcast, I binged the whole 13-episode arc of the Luke Cage TV series on Netflix. Just kind of got me involved in and in reinterested again in black music of a certain period, and there's a lot of that in the Luke Cage miniseries, including bands like the Stylistics and the Delphonics, and it's a kind of a very, very cool soundtrack, which I believe is coming out on vinyl and on download. And there are a lot of tracks on the Luke Cage soundtrack. It may well be worth Morris or one of our friends getting a hold of that and doing a couple of podcasts about it. It's really good on the subject matter, and does it in a visually interesting way as well, which is always nice. I've seen documentaries where the interviews were great, but the visual interest wasn't maintained. But this one really does nail that, and it's definitely recommended. So I pretty much enjoyed Sample This. I then saw a sequel to a very famous science fiction movie, which has now become an HBO miniseries, and that's Future World, the sequel to Westworld, which stars Peter Fonda and Blythe Danner. Arthur Hill's in it as well, and Stuart Margolin. It's a kind of sequel after all the shit goes down at Westworld. The Delos people who own the theme parks with all the robots in it decide that they're going to create another world called Future World. Westworld itself has been axed. And a couple of investigative journalists, played by Peter Fonda and Blythe Danner, go and on a junket, basically, to Future World, but find out that things are not as they think they are. And it's a very much a lower budget and kind of less focused sequel. There's a lot of running around industrial gantries and things like that, being chased by killer robots and all that kind of thing. There's a cameo in a very weird way from Yul Brynner from the first one, because his gunfighter, based of course on Chris from The Magnificent Seven, was iconic in Westworld, and so they had to bring it in for one dream sequence in Future World. It's definitely much a lesser sequel, which spun off into a very, very brief television series called Beyond Westworld, which had an extremely short run in 1980. It starred Jim McMullen, Connie Sellecker. Seven Darden was in it, which makes it kind of interesting. But I really haven't seen it since it first came out. I'm not sure, even sure whether it's been released on any form of media. But Future World came up on my streaming media queue, and so I thought, yeah, I'll give it a go. And yeah, it is pretty fucking ordinary, really. There's also one of the things that kind of shocked me a little bit is Peter Fonda's character's sexual politics with Blythe Danner's character. There's a little bit of kind of office romance kind of thing happening there, but in a way that we now find wrong. I'll let you find that yourself if you bother watching Future World. So what else have I been watching? I did see a documentary on Netflix, which I appreciated, called X-Rated, which is a list of the greatest adult films of all time. Now, it's a list that I can kind of disagree with some parts of, but the thing I found most interesting in the list, but it hits all the big marks like Behind the Green Door and Deep Throat and The Devil and Miss Jones and a few other things. Cafe Flesh is in there as well. But the interesting thing is the interviews with the people who were involved in them. And the great thing about it, which surprised me, and I stereotyped people because they worked in the adult film industry in my own head. I didn't realize until I saw this documentary, is that a lot of them came out as intelligent, articulate tradespeople who are basically making a product exactly the same way that, say, a small independent mainstream Hollywood film is, except with double penetration. But the interesting thing was that perspective that they had, saying, talking more about the ways that these films were made, than about what they were made about. And that makes it a kind of interesting documentary. Some of the people, particularly the male directors, a couple of them come off as sleazy, but the rest of them are articulate and intelligent and kind of cool. And they talk about some of the other actors involved in it. So in a sense, it's a valid piece of film history. Maybe it's not to everybody's interest. I know there are a lot of people out there that don't like adult material and have objections to pornography. And I understand those perspectives, and I respect that people hold those opinions. I'm not going to try to make somebody watch an adult film. But from the film buff point of view, I found it a really interesting documentary. And also a cautionary tale in the sense of people don't look very good when they use too much filler and have too much plastic surgery, as some of the people involved in some of the adult films clearly have. And on the other hand, there were a lot of kind of women of a certain age who had been in the adult industry 20, 30, 40 years ago, who they have a natural look, which is really kind of appealing. And the fact that they're honest about their past and have embraced it and talk about it in an articulate and nostalgic way made it more interesting than it might have been had it just been a cheap compilation of porn clips and generic voiceover. It actually does work well, and I really appreciated seeing that side of an industry that in my youth I supported. The other thing I want to talk about that I saw was on Netflix. It's an Australian film. It runs roughly an hour, so it's not a full-length feature film. But it's a movie called Restoration from 2015. I think there were two movies called Restoration that came out in 2015. This is an Australian one. It's science fiction as well. It's set slightly in the future, and the situation is that people have their memories backed up, and they have the option of having kind of generic bodies. Should anything happen to them, they could be resurrected as a copy. And so wealthy people, including the protagonist in this film, have their memories regularly backed up. The problem comes when, by accident, the upload of the person's memory gets downloaded into someone else's body, and that person thinks that they're the person whose memories they have received. And so he goes after the actual person from whom the memories were uploaded and wants to overwrite that person's memories with his own, so that in a sense he exists and he continues where the person from whom he was originally generated, and I'm explaining this incredibly badly, actually dies. So the movie raises some questions about the nature of reality, and is a perfect copy of someone the same as that person? The movie does set up a few things suggesting that that's not the case. And it has a cast of actors, some of whom are better than others. And there's also a couple of problems with it. The guy who receives the memory accidentally has a broad Australian accent, whereas the person he's supposed to have been generated from has an educated Australian accent. And maybe it's only Australians who would recognise that. But the differences in the accents really jarred for me. And nonetheless, it's a movie that from young filmmakers that is worth checking out. And I think it's good to encourage people to do this kind of thing. And of course, when you've got a very limited budget, you don't always have the time or the ability to get things exactly right. Nonetheless, Restoration was a little bit of a fun watch. I enjoyed it. It's filmed and set here in Melbourne. And there's also another character involved in this kind of little fracas, which is a little bit face-offish. And that is the doctor slash nurse, and it's never clear whether she's a doctor or a nurse, that's why I'm saying that, who monitors and facilitates the uploads. She becomes involved when her child is kidnapped by the copy of this other guy. And she has her own ways of managing that as well. This is one of those films that, like a couple of other short films, may, and at 59 minutes, it may be considered a short film. I think with a bigger budget and maybe some different casting choices, this would make a good, solid science fiction full-length feature film. But again, limitations of budget, limitations of time available restricted this. And I hope that the money they got from Netflix for hosting, you know, for putting the movie onto the Netflix platform is used to let these filmmakers make some interesting projects, because that would be really good. I think they've got the chops, but I think that maybe those limitations overwhelm them slightly in making restoration. And it's one of those films that goes back to that interesting thing about streaming platforms. They can give an audience to films that might not get seen otherwise. You know, you're surfing through the menus on there and you try to find something that you haven't seen before or you haven't heard bad things about. And a little movie with an interesting premise comes up, so you give it a go. That was the way it was when I did Advantageous, another small Netflix-based film Jennifer Pong directed, which is a really good, solid science fiction film. It's one of the best science fiction films I've seen in 5 years. But again, it's a small little, it's a small film done on a relatively limited budget, but it may well find its audience on streaming platforms. Streaming is fairly new. We don't really know how word of mouth will work on it and whether there will be breakthrough small films that come off that. But I like the fact that these small, quirky films are actually getting displayed for people and that the opportunity has arisen to see them on these platforms. And from a movie buff point of view, I see this as only a good thing. So that's pretty much what I've been watching. I'm going to take a little break now. When I get back, I'm going to talk about a bunch of films you can see on YouTube and Vimeo and other streaming platforms that don't charge money, but that I think are really good and are worth your time. And it won't take much of your time. These things are not long films. You could do them in a lunch break if you want to, but they're good science fiction. So for the break, I'm going to play a track that I really want to put into a horror movie. I think it's creepy enough to go into a horror movie. I'm never going to make one, of course, but having said that, I really like this as a kind of slightly spooky, eerie, sad, tristesse kind of song by one of the kind of icons of my podcasting career, Miss Toni Fisher. And it is Why Can't the Dark Leave Me Alone? So if you look at this from the viewpoint of slotting it somewhere into a horror movie, I think it works really well.
Strange how the dark makes you remember. Strange little things out of the past. Things like a chance, casual glance, things like a joke, or like the times we'd smoke that last cigarette. Why must the dark make me remember all of those things I should forget? Why must I wake from my sleep craving a love that is gone? Why can't the dark leave me alone? Why must the dark bring you close to me? Why must the dark light the way? Eyes to me, back to the times when you whispered sighs to me. Oh, why must the dark make me remember all of those things I should forget? Why must I wake from my sleep, craving love that is gone? Why can't the dark leave me alone? Why can't the dark leave me alone? So
the first one we're going to talk about is on YouTube, and there's a couple of different versions of it because it's based on a short story by Terry Bisson called They're Made Out of Meat. Premise is pretty simple. Two aliens sitting in a diner, they're disguised as human beings, and they're discussing their discoveries about planet Earth. Here's a little taste, Boomtish, of it.
They're made out of meat.
Meat?
There's no doubt about it. We picked up several from different parts of the planet, took them aboard our recon vessels, and probed them all the way through. They are completely meat.
It's impossible. What about the radio signals?
They use radio signals to talk. But the signals don't come from them. The signals come from machines.
Well, who made the machines? That's who we need to contact.
Meat made the machines.
It's ridiculous. Meat can't make machines.
These creatures are the only sentient race in this sector, and they're made out of meat.
So that's the premise. It's a 6-minute movie. It's quirky and fun and a little bit silly. It stars Tom Noonan, who people remember from any number of films. He's got quite a large cult film reputation. And Ben Bailey. And it really works as a short film. It's punchy, it's funny, it talks about prejudice in a humorous way. It also talks about our preconceptions of interstellar life. And Terry Bisson, well-known science fiction writer, and it's just a perfect short film. It's one of those things that people would do for a student project. And it really does work. It's a lot of fun, and it's a good way to kind of start this discussion because podcasters are made out of meat. So now we get to a more serious one with a nice piece of acting in it. Kurt Woodsmith, people remember from the that 70s show, playing the father, Red, in that show. But he's also a good character actor. He was in a Star Trek movie, apart from anything else. And he was Clarence Boudica, one of the big bads in RoboCop, one of the criminals. And he does a small half-an-hour film in 1990 called 12:01 PM, directed by Jonathan Heap and written by Richard Lupov. And it's a lovely piece of cinema. It's small, concise, mind-blowing concepts. It works really well, and Kurt Woodsmith's acting is perfect in this film. It's from 1990, and it was remade as a full-length feature film by Jonathan Heap in 1993, but the original half-hour version works a lot better for me. I'll just play a little bit. Kurt Woodsmith plays a man who, well, he'll explain that part, but he's talking to a young lady on a park bench at lunchtime. They're both eating their lunch, and they strike up a conversation. And there's a bit of rapport between them. It's a kind of meet-cute sort of situation. But he's a very troubled man, and there's a very important and world-shattering reason why.
Dolores. Something terrible has happened to the whole world, the whole universe. You see, it's like we're stuck. You know, like a needle on a scratched record. It all starts at 12:01, and everything goes along fine until 1 o'clock, and then bam, the whole world snaps back to 12:01 again, like the whole hour never happened, and everything goes back to the way it was. Everything. So that each hour seems new, the fifth time or the 5,000,000th time, except to me. My memory's not erased. I am the only one that knows he's repeating the same hour. I'm sorry, I scared you, I'm sorry. But I'll tell you, you know what the worst part is? Well, it's all starting to seem normal to me now.
It's a great little film, and it is on YouTube as well. Before you start thinking it's just kind of like a serious version of Groundhog Day, the movie was made in 1990. Groundhog Day came out in 1993. In fact, Richard Lupoff was considering suing the studio that made Groundhog Day for stealing his idea, but he didn't have the financial means, and his legal advisors advised him that it wouldn't be successful. But nonetheless, this is kind of the original concept. In fact, it was nominated for an Oscar for Best Live Action Short Film. It didn't win, but at least it was nominated. And it is a nice, tight, and good science fiction piece of cinema. And you should see it. I'm really fond of this one. And every time I watch it, I'm drawn back to Kurtwood Smith's acting. I think it's just the best. It gives a difficult concept. And Kurtwood Smith gets into the head of a man who's in a situation that makes Sisyphus look easy. The next one's about a man with an incredible problem as well. And it's being remade as a movie next year with Martin Freeman. In fact, it's already filming. And it's a 2013 film that was made for the Australian Short Film Festival, Tropfest, and it's called Cargo. It's 7 minutes long, and it's fucking terrific. It starts out with a man waking up. His car's just crashed, and he wakes up kind of dizzy and disoriented. He's in his seatbelt in the front seat, and he hears a noise coming from next to him. Looks over, and his wife, has been killed in the car accident, but she's become a zombie. They're out in the bush. They're trying to escape the zombie apocalypse. The car has crashed, and the wife's died and become a zombie. That's one problem, and not a small one at all. But that's not the problem the movie spins around. The problem is his baby daughter's in the back seat. So he gets her out of the back seat and takes her around the back of the car and realizes that while he was asleep, his wife bit him, and that he is going to turn into a zombie. They're out in the bush. There's nobody else around. And his baby daughter is relying on him. How does he make it so that when he turns into a zombie, he doesn't kill and eat his own child? Now, that's a fucking good premise for a small film. And it plays out really, really well. It's just perfect as a small film. And it combines a lot of important things. It combines love. I mean, the love of a parent for his child. And the guy playing the father, Andy Rotterdam, is really good in this as well. It's a nice piece of acting. And the desperation of the man is palpable. And the solution that he finds to the problem in this concise and really, really oddly heartwarming film is imaginative and well thought out and a little bit left field. I'm not going to do a spoiler on it. It's on YouTube. If you type in Cargo 2013, you're going to find it on YouTube. And it's one of the finalists for Tropfest. And I'm kind of glad that the filmmaker, Ben Howling and Yolanda Ramke, filmmakers, got a chance to make this on a larger budget as a feature-length film. I'm not sure how it will play out as a feature film, but the concept of the short film and the delivery of that concept of the short film is really a lovely piece of cinema. It's it reminded me in some ways of These Final Hours, that Western Australian set apocalypse film that I've talked about on Martian Drive-In before. And I like this film for another reason too. It shows a man being strong, but not in a macho slashing the heads off zombies kind of way. It's him finding a solution to a problem and showing the best aspects of his own character in the way that he solves this problem of what's he going to do when he turns into a zombie and his baby daughter needs to survive. And the thing is, the movie ends on a really heartwarming note. I got choked up rewatching it when I saw the last bit of the film. It really does work incredibly well as a short film. I'm not sure as a feature film, as I said, but Cargo from 2013 is worth checking out. And the other thing it shows too, which is quite important, and of course we know this because of the raft of different zombie movies we've got out there, is that zombie movies, for some reason, and much to our delight, of course, are a very broad church. There are comedy zombie movies, there are serious ones, there are all kinds of different zombie movies, and this one shows that there's always something new to say in any genre, and that with a little thought and a little care, that you can create something new and quite beautiful out of a genre that a lot of people think is pretty much tapped out. Kind of like the genre of time travel, but it isn't. And a 2014 short film, which is about 8.5 minutes long, called 1 Minute Time Machine, shows that. Sorry, I misspoke. It's actually 5.5 minutes long.
Excuse me. Do you mind if I,
Free country. What's that?
Oh, nothing.
Sure it's not a 1 minute time machine?
Huh? Damn it. Excuse me. Do you mind if I,
It's freight country. What's that?
Well, it certainly isn't a 1 minute time machine. Damn it.
So basically, this one is a short time travel rom-com, which has some scary implications about time travel, and it plays with the concept and runs it as far as it can, and it's a lot of fun. It's a kind of cute short break. If you have a coffee break and you want to just kind of suck in some media, this is definitely one to do. If you haven't seen it before, it's worth seeing. It's directed by a guy called Devon Avery, and it's a two-hander. There's only the two people in the film. James, played by Brian Dietzen, and Regina, played by Erin Hayes. And they've got a nice rapport too, which is something that it's a little hard to get sometimes in a short film, because there's not really that time to build the kind of rapport and the relationships. But I think these two really kind of work well together. The dialogue's sharp and smart and clever. The time loops that keep happening are kind of amusing and surprising at the same time. And yet, there are some scary implications to it, which we see play out in a bunch of parallel universes. I'm not going to do a spoiler on it, but it's a lot of fun, and it cheers you up every time you watch it. It's got a kind of little, it has its own music score, just a kind of light little friendly score that sounds a bit like this. And it's one of those kind of short films that makes you want to see more from the people who made it, because you know that they've got something good up their sleeve and they're just waiting for the funding and the wherewithal to do it. And in fact, it's the second one of the movies with time loops in it, as well as 12:01 p.m., which feature two people sitting and talking on a park bench. And I'm sure that 1 Minute Time Machine may well have been inspired by 12:01, but... and I really like the fact that you can make a science fiction film, which is, conceptually pretty cool, and it has some interesting concepts that it plays with, with an incredibly small budget and basically just an outdoor setting, which requires absolutely no cost to create the set. And that in itself is pretty damn cool. Science fiction is the literature of ideas, and to demonstrate an idea, sometimes you don't need a lot in the way of props or special effects. All of the kind of, in this movie, all of the special effects are done in the editing room. It's just purely through the cutting. And the movie does get the continuity pretty right too, which is always a difficult thing when you're talking about time loops. Does the sun and the outdoor setting look the same the second time you go through a time loop as the first? And they seem to get it pretty right. I couldn't see anything that to me looked like a continuity error of any kind. And it's a little film that's just cute and sweet and funny and monstrously horrible all at the same time. Then we come to an action film, which is 8 minutes long, 8 minutes 40 long, and it's called Singularity, by a group calling themselves the Bicycle Monarchy.
and it's like a small piece of a much larger film. The special effects are incredibly good. The CG in it is terrific. And it's the story of a Delta Force team that land in a hospital in Washington, D.C. during a singularity event when robots are taking over. And their job is to find and extract the president from that hospital and get him out while the hospital is under siege from some very creepy looking robots. The robots in this one are fucking scary fuckers. We don't have enough time for character development, but there are action scenes as the team make their way through the hospital, find the president, take him out, get him on the helicopter to get him out of Washington. And that's pretty much it for 8.5 minutes. It's more exciting than a Michael Bay film, but it's much shorter. Now, it's not perfect as well, but on the other hand, and the kind of twist in the tale is fairly obvious. Nonetheless, it's action-packed. It's incredibly well-filmed, and it does the job. It's almost like a calling card for a much larger gig to the Bicycle Monarchy people. And to be honest with you, it's a larger movie that I wouldn't mind seeing. It's definitely action-packed, a lot of fun. I like singularity event movies, and I like singularity event fiction, which is a cinematic genre that goes back at least as far as Metropolis, with a few scenic stops along the way for things like Colossus, the Forbidden Project, and Saturn III, and a number of other films, and even something as shitty as Disney's The Black Hole can be seen in some ways as a kind of singularity movie with the killer robots taking over the space station and all that kind of stuff. The nice thing about singularity, and by the way, you can go to the website of the filmmakers, which is, let me have a look here, thebicyclemonarchy.com, and you'll be able to check the film out there. Or what you can do is in the search part of YouTube, you can type in Singularity, The Bicycle Monarchy, and it will bring you up the film. Which brings me to an Australian short film, which I only just saw. I was doing a little bit of a search in between recording bits for this podcast, and I found a movie called Time Trap, written and directed by a guy called Michael Shanks, who I don't think is the same guy who was in Stargate. But it's about an alien that has a bit of a malfunction with his spaceship as he's coming through the solar system and crashes on a destroyed Earth. In fact, the Earth is so destroyed it's in two pieces. Fortunately, he needs repairs materials. Fortunately, he has a thing called a time trap, which enables him to create bubbles of space-time in the past. And so he goes back to modern era Earth a few times to find what he needs to repair his spaceship, which is a very unusual looking thing. It looks like it's made with Minecraft, but it's a cute little film. The alien's quite cute, and it's actually a guy in a suit, but the way the guy in the suit part is done is quite interesting, and you do get to see a bit of the alien's lower face, and you realise he's not quite human. There's some fantastic special effects shots in this one. There's a special effects shot of the spaceship going across the surface of Jupiter, which is beautiful to look at. And there are also some really nice kind of post-apocalyptic stuff of Sydney Harbour and the alien creating time bubbles all around him to find the stuff that he needs in order to repair his spaceship and get on his way. It's a cute little film. It's not, apparently it did do the film festival circuit, but it didn't win any awards. But it's cute and it's fun and it's interesting and it's original, and that's the other thing. It's got a lot of originality, a lot of creativity to it, and it is just a hell of a lot of fun. So again, it's about 7 to 9 minutes long, and it's obviously, from what I can read, taken years to put the movie together. Nonetheless, it is a great little film. That sound effect's actually from a Halloween toy that I bought the other day, which is a kind of a wand shaped like a skull on the end of a bone with a little red LED at the end of it. and it also makes that noise when you wave it around and press the button. So I think I might just use that to kind of show when I'm ending talking about one thing in a podcast and move on to the next subject. Tell me if it gets annoying, but we'll see how it goes. So on to Code 46, a 2003 futuristic science fiction movie directed by Michael Winterbottom. I'll play the trailer and then I'll talk about the things I think that work with this film and some pretty important things that I think don't work.
How do people live out here?
It's not living. Just existing.
An investigator with a special gift.
Your password is Kari-4.
How did you know that?
I listened to you while you weren't speaking.
Has only 24 hours to unravel a mystery.
The last 14 days, 3 people have died.
I need to speak to Miss Gonzalez alone. Tell me what you're doing later tonight.
Is that a question or an invitation?
So am I under surveillance?
But this suspect is more than she seems.
Every time I ever imagine this, I always imagine being with you.
Are you in love with this woman?
Why?
She violated Code 46.
Academy Award winner Tim Robbins.
There was a woman here, Maria Gonzalez.
She's gone.
Gone? What do you mean gone?
Academy Award nominee Samantha Morton.
She has been sent outside.
Why did you do it?
What?
Lie for me.
How do you solve a crime?
Something's happened.
Will you save me?
When the last thing you want to know is the truth.
Now you know all my secrets.
Code 46.
Code 46, as I said, is a kind of dystopian, futuristic science fiction movie. Directed by Michael Winterbottom, a guy who people know from a lot of things, including 24-Hour Party People and The Trip, the one with Rob Brydon and Steve Coogan wandering around playing different versions of themselves as they travel around the place. The movie was filmed in Dubai, Shanghai and Rajasthan in India. It creates a very different futuristic world. People in the media, the bits I've read about it, have said it's a near future world. But given the background and the texture of the movie, I get the feeling that it's a lot further down the line than we think it is, because there's a lot of kind of cross-cultural polyglot mixing. There's a genetic mixing between peoples. People who don't look like a particular ethnicity have ethnic names. People who do look like a certain ethnicity have names of other ethnicities. It's a kind of melting pot future, and in its own way quite dystopian. I'll give you a little bit of the start of the film. It's a very long and convoluted plot, but I'll try to give you a feel for it. Here's a bit from Wikipedia. In the near future, see, it says the near future here, but it's wrong. In the future, the world is divided between those who live inside in high-density cities and the poor underclass who live outside, which is mostly desert due to climate degradation. Access to the cities is highly restricted and regulated through the use of health documents known as papels. Most city residents venture outside only after dark, since direct sunlight is now considered hazardous to their health. However, many residents still venture outdoors during the day. The government appears to be authoritarian and dystopian. Society is regulated by various codes. The Code 46 of the movie's title prohibits genetically incestuous reproduction, which may occur as a result of various medical technologies which have become commonplace, such as cloning. William Geld, Tim Robbins, is an insurance fraud investigator. Is sent to Shanghai to interview employees at a company known as the Sphinx, which manufactures covers, ostensibly insurance cover documents, but which in fact regulate the movement of people among the cities and between the inside and the outside. William's assignment is to identify employees who are suspected of forging covers. After interviewing numerous Sphinx employees, Guild identifies a young worker named Maria Gonzalez, Samantha Morton, as a forger. He is able to do this by using a genetically engineered empathy virus, which allows him to gain information from people if they voluntarily reveal something about themselves. Maria tells William that... we'll leave that bit. So that's basically the setup of the film. Somebody also said something very interesting about this film online, and that is that it's a science fiction version of a much older film. And I didn't pick up on this the two times that I've seen this film, but it makes sense to me to a certain point. And that movie that it resembles is Brief Encounter, the movie based on a Noel Coward play, starring Celia Johnson and Trevor Howard as married people who meet at a train station and start a relationship of sorts between themselves in a very kind of British upper middle class kind of way. And this movie does have some parallels to that, though they can only be taken to a certain point. The two of them fall in love. The authorities find out about this. They find out some of the results of the covers being forged and what happens to one guy who, using a forged cover, goes to India to study bats because he's very interested in studying bats, but ends up being susceptible to a particular disease that is transmitted by bats and meets a very ugly death off screen. So yeah, there's a lot of textures and layers to this movie. It's got some interesting actors in it, apart from Tim Robbins and Samantha Morton, who are both very good actors. It's got Om Puri starring as one of the bosses at Sphinx. And Australia's Essie Davis turns up as well as a doctor, which is kind of interesting. Very multicultural cast too. Togo Igawa plays the driver who drives Guild to and from the city. Nabil Eluahabi is... a guy called Nabil, who's a street vendor. Nina Wadia plays a hospital receptionist. Archie Panjab is a check-in agent. So basically, there's a beautifully multicultural cast to this movie, and it's got a very multicultural feel as well. The merging of cultures is interesting too. People say ni hao instead of hello in the manner of Chinese. There are all sorts of different loan words from different languages in the way people speak, and you get the idea that the government, of whatever kind of government it is, which is very much off the scene and is only ever seen through the actions of small numbers of medical people mostly, is very much dystopian and authoritarian. It's controlling where people go and what they do. And at a deeper level, because of the use of viruses, can control what they think and what they remember. Though this isn't widely used or widely recognized as being used. One of the interesting things is in a conversation between William and Maria, she talks about learning a foreign language through a virus. And she found it very confusing because the people she spoke with knew what she was saying, but she didn't. She didn't understand it. So there are kind of teething problems with these viruses. And one of the other interesting bits is that when William goes to a certain place to talk to some people, his empathy virus doesn't work. There's some antivirals in the atmosphere that give him a runny nose, which means that the virus isn't working as an empathy virus. So the script does have some very good science fiction elements in it. It's by a long-term Michael Winterbottom collaborator, Frank Cotterill Boyce, who, amongst other things, did a lot of other Michael Winterbottom movies, including writing 24-Hour Party People, and also wrote a sequel to, oddly enough, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which was quite successful. So the movie kind of has that beautiful, interesting texturing to it. The music is kind of fun as well. It was composed by David Holmes under the name of Free Association. So a lot of it's mash-up and kind of ambient music to a certain extent. But it does build atmosphere nicely for the background of this film. And the use of the locations is particularly important. Shanghai, of course, being a high-tech city. Dubai being a high-tech desert city. And Rajasthan for the scenes of the outside in the poorer areas. Makes really this kind of multicultural and international futuristic world very effective on a relatively limited budget. In a way, it reminded me of
a much older film, Alphaville. Jean-Luc Godard's movie from the 1960s starring Eddie Constantine. Alphaville used what was then modern Paris to talk about a futuristic city on another planet, and filmed at night and with very close attention to certain details of what is around Paris. They gave the kind of eerie impression that it was actually a futuristic high-tech city, even though in reality it wasn't. And this is a bit what happens in Code 46. By specifically using certain bits and pieces of Shanghai, Rajasthan and Dubai, they very much gave the impression of a very multicultural and textured international world. Now, I've been to Dubai. Sally and I spent a number of days there just after this film was made. And Dubai is a wonderful city. But people now go there for rave parties and all sorts of other things. But I really like old Dubai, the high-tech, modern, high-rise Dubai. I'm not particularly fond of, but the souks I like. The old town on the north side of the River Dera is interesting. And one of the things in the movie that made me very nostalgic for Dubai was that the two main characters in the film take an Abra ride across the core Dubai. Now, an Abra is a little flat, well, not particularly little, but a little commuter boat, diesel-powered, that runs from one side of Dubai to the other across the core Dubai, which is a wide inlet which separates one side of town from the other. And for about 15 dirhams, which is like 30 cents Australian, you get on an Abra and ride across the river. And it's a very cool ride. You get to see people in dhows loading and unloading produce and products that have been shipped across the Arabian Sea from India. And it's just got a wonderful feel to it, riding an Abra in Dubai. It's one of those great things that if you've been to Dubai and you haven't done that, you've pissed away an opportunity. It really is a great place. The souks as well, the markets there are fantastic. And seeing it portrayed in this movie as a futuristic city in a dystopian world seems oddly apt. The combination of the dry desert and the high-rise high-tech makes it a very interesting and very different place than I'm familiar with. And we kind of embraced it the way when Sally and I travel, which is unfortunately not nearly often enough. We tend to have the philosophy of leave yourself open to experience. Don't try to over-plan the holiday. Just kind of leave yourself open to random influences. And usually you have a great time with it. And that's the way our trip to Dubai was. We were going to go on a coach tour around Dubai, but we crunched the numbers and found out it was cheaper to get a taxi to where we wanted to go and do it ourselves. And we got to see some interesting things that we wouldn't have seen by going on to a very structured and formal tour bus. So the movie works in a number of ways. The future world that it creates is interesting and layered and textured, and the technologies that control the world are mostly invisible, being viruses and surveillance technologies of various kinds. The way bureaucracy is the medium by which people are controlled, and access to and from and restrictions in travel are used to control and manipulate and influence populaces, is something that with refugee policies as they are coming nowadays, is a quite a relevant and cogent look at some of the negative sides of the future. So all of that really works, and it's one of those movies you've got to pay close attention to what's on the screen and the little bits of the dialogue, because a lot of the information about this world is verbally communicated or obliquely alluded to by what you see on the screen. They don't spoon feed you. You've got to go out and forage for the information. Now, that works really well, and the story itself works well. The fact that William and Maria breach Code 46 without knowing it, basically because Maria is a clone of William's mother, and he doesn't know that. She becomes aware of it when she becomes pregnant and finds out that she's done a Code 46 breach. And there are certain consequences and certain penalties for doing that. There are certain penalties to both parties. But this powerful and dystopian bureaucracy has an emphasis towards one of the two parties because that person provides a more useful social function than the other one. So the punishments meted out for this breach of quite an important law are uneven and unbalanced and unfair. There's no question of it. But having said that, here's the weakness of this movie, and it's a weakness that undermines everything else. At the heart of this film, it's a love story between two very different people from different parts of the world, one of whom is a married man, the other of whom is somebody who breaks the law in order to make ends meet and to get a little extra money. Tim Robbins and Samantha Morton have zero chemistry as a couple. They really don't have that spark and that fire that you need for this kind of thing. The way that Celia Johnson and Trevor Howard did in Brief Encounter, the way any kind of romantic couple in a movie need to have in order to intensify and give verisimilitude to the relationship that's on the screen. And these two just simply don't. There's also the odd physical problem of Tim Robbins being about 6'3", 6'4", and Samantha Morton being small. He kind of looms over her a lot, and that creates a kind of awkward impression visually as well, which doesn't serve the point the story is trying to make. And that's a big problem with this kind of a film. You've really got to have that spark and that fire, and the people involved have to be kind of interesting. And these two characters are, apart from small moments of Samantha Morton's Maria, pretty dull people. Of course, that could be said of the two characters in Brief Encounter as well. But they seem to be more inhabited and more textured than these two are. And the charisma of Trevor Howard and Celia Johnson, along with the script, based on a Noel Coward play, where a lot of the things being said are only alluded to obliquely while people are talking about other things, make Brief Encounter one of the great romantic tragedies of 20th century cinema. Isn't the case with this one. It really does lack that fire and that spark and that chemistry and that wonder and that on-screen magic that we really need for this kind of a film to work. Now, Winterbottom's a very good visual stylist, but nobody's ever accused him of being an actor's director. And I think that's the flaw in the film. I like the story, I like the setting, I like the world that's created, even though I hate it as well, as you should with a good dystopia in a film. But the two lead characters just don't, you know, they're the main two tent poles of this film, and they just don't lift the tent high enough. Which is a shame, because I watched this film probably around the time it first came out, within a year or two of it coming out. And then I wanted to revisit again for this podcast because of that kind of world building that occurs in the making of the film. And then I went, no, these characters are pretty fucking dull. And that's a big problem. It's a real, enormously big problem. But nonetheless, I think the movie's worth seeing. I think that the world created, while owing something to a number of other people, including people like William Gibson, this kind of film is always going to be compared to the work of William Gibson. There's no way to avoid that. But it doesn't err on the side of stealing from Gibson. It's more kind of informed by cyberpunks than it is cribbing from them. And that's the way it should be, too. If you're going to dip into a genre, a literary genre for a movie, you can't steal. You can kind of have an awareness of the way those kinds of worlds and those kinds of stories are built. And I definitely think that Code 46 does that. But at the heart of the film are two actors with no chemistry at all, and that really fucks it up. But anyway, that's about it this time around. I tried something different with the short films at the start, and then talking about Code 46. But I hope it went well. Anyway, it's time, of course, to do the credits. So thank you to the two Careys who are podcast supporters through Patreon. And thank you to the listeners. Thank you, too, to our friend Rich Chamberlain, who gave Martian Drive-In Podcast a shout-out on his website, Monster Kid Radio. So really appreciate that, and thank you for the love there, Rich. And I'll be back next week with a Paleo Cinema podcast, in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. We are creeping up fast on the 100th episode of Martian Drive-In and the 200th episode of Paleo Cinema. So please, someone give me an idea what I should do for the big one, because the clock is ticking and I've just got no fucking idea. But anyway, look after yourselves. Look after each other. Live large. Watch good movies. Watch bad movies. Don't vote for Trump. I just saw the second debate, by the way. And I will be back. So here, as usual, are the other. I'll catch you guys later. Thank you to all of the Patreon subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and thank all of them. We have Tom, our focus puller. Sarah, our special effects technician. Ian, our caterer. Grant, our Technicolor consultant. Claire, our script doctor. Gary, our prop master. Morris, our music director. Jan, our dialect coach. Armin, our key grip. Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler. Elaine, our scientific advisor. Julia, our casting director. Chris, our camera operator. Christopher, our gaffer. Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress. Tansy, the foley artist. Alyssa, the location scout. Mark, our second unit director. Paul, our special makeup effects director. Tammy, our donut wrangler. Tim, our New York unit director. Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor. Steve, our script doctor. Dylan, our goat wrangler. Eric, our set security lead. Kerry, our second script doctor. Richard, our set photographer. And our extras, Kathleen, Mark, and David. And let's not forget Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, and Richard C., our transportation co-captain. So thank you very much to all the subscribers, and you too can subscribe at patreon.com/paleocinema.